Welcome to the UFO File Show with your host, Jerry Pippin.
It's Jerry Pippin. Welcome to the UFO Files, and we're broadcasting from Roswell, the 60th anniversary, and we're here at the Civic Center, and we'll be here until noon again tomorrow, 10 until noon. So if you're around, have a chance to come on by, please do, and visit us. We have a booth as well, and right next to our booth is a Fate Magazine booth, and one of my favorite ghostwriters, and I hope you don't call me, when I call you a ghostwriter, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, I don't mean you're writing for other people. You're writing about ghosts. You go to mansions that are haunted and spend the night by yourself. Incredible. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jerry, and it's really nice to see you again. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has, and we look forward to seeing you all the time. You're one of our favorite people. Now, you're very busy. You're leaving here. You're going to Kentucky. What's in Kentucky?
I'm doing an investigation of the Waverly Hills Sanatorium, which is a ruined tuberculosis sanatorium and old nursing home just outside on the outskirts of Louisville. It's quite haunted. And I'm going to be there two nights in a row doing all-night investigations.
What do you do exactly when you investigate these haunted houses?
We take in equipment. We try to capture anomalies on video, digital camera. We set up recorders for electronic voice phenomena. We take EMF readings. And sometimes people bring in psychics, too, but I don't think we have a psychic in our group. But we, in other words, we try and capture hard data of haunting phenomena. And usually, almost anyone who goes to a place like Waverly, which is incredibly haunted, you're going to have experiences yourself.
Have you been able to record one of those voices before?
I do EVP, yes. Yeah. I do both EVP and ITC.
ITC, what does that mean?
That's instrumental trance communication.
What is that? Something shows up in the needle's jump or what?
Well, it's the next evolutionary stage from EVP. In electronic voice phenomena, you set a tape recorder out, and then you hear voices on playback. But ITC is two-way real-time. You have devices that facilitate two-way real-time communication. It's almost like a mediumistic interface.
So when you say two-way communication, are you talking about you could actually talk to the entity?
That's the idea. That
anybody ever talked to you?
Oh yes, I've
really?
Had
what,
yes.
What kind of thing? What kind of conversation do you have, Rosemary?
Well, usually with these interfaces, you're lucky to get a short answer. You might ask for your name. You might ask for someone, whoever is coming through this device, to identify the people present. And it's not unusual to hear your own name called out through these devices. You can ask yes and no questions. You might zero in on a specific entity, like if you know there's a particular haunting presence.
This place in Kentucky, mm-hmm. Who's supposed to be haunting that place?
Well, actually, there's like no dominant ghost of an individual. There are so many ghosts there from the tuberculosis victims and also the nursing home victims that there are just a lot of anonymous spirits going around. Now, I'm not going to use ITC at Waverly. I believe that ITC should be used for research with the higher realms, where we tune into advanced beings who are attempting to help us build bridges to cut across these dimensions.
Rosemary Ellen Guiley, you're very prolific, and I mean that in a compliment. You write a lot of things. What are you doing now that people can pick up as far as books and whatever? You may be making movies by now. I know you're going back out to Hollywood pretty soon.
Yes, I'm doing a number of documentaries. I have one coming out on Sci-Fi this fall called Children of the Grave, featuring the League of Paranormal Gentlemen, of which I'm a member, even though I'm
not a gentleman. I've noticed that.
I guess I'm the female sidekick. But no, it's great. They're a great group of guys. I'm working with top-notch people like John Zaffis and Troy Taylor and Keith Age. The Booth Brothers are producing that. I'm going to be in a Mysterious Journeys for the Travel Channel on witchcraft in Salem in the fall. And then I'm going out to L.A. to discuss some international film projects.
Hey, great.
I have a new ghost encyclopedia coming out in August.
You've had one before, didn't you?
This is the third edition.
Yeah,
I've just
right.
revised it for the third edition.
And when we talk about ghost encyclopedias, what are we... Everything's listed A through Z, or what?
It's A through Z. It's famous places, cases, phenomena, research, personalities, folklore, cross-cultural, but mostly about North American cases.
And you list each of these incidents in there, and what would I find if I picked that book up? What would that, would it be in great detail, each story? Or
I go into as much detail as I possibly can. Okay. For example, when I write up a famous haunted place like Waverly, there would be a lot of history of the place, then the haunting activity, and what some of the explanations are for the haunting activity. Can we verify some of the activity against history so we can identify perhaps personalities that might be present? With Waverly, there are so many figures and a lot of dark entities that we call shadow people. It's difficult to pinpoint specific cases there.
Well, let's talk about the shadow people for a moment. Tell me a little bit about this. What are we talking about here?
Shadow people are a fascinating area that I started researching in depth about 2 years ago, mainly because of these dark figures that I came across in haunted locations. And then I also became aware of another kind of shadow person, which is the nighttime bedside visitor. A person wakes up in the middle of the night and sees a looming, usually tall, male, hatted, coated figure beside the bed or in a corner of the room, and it's quite a terrifying experience. Well, I found that there really wasn't much written up in the literature on shadow people, so I thought, well, I think I better find out about this. Collect a few dozen articles, stories, write an article.
So basically, who are these shadow people?
Well, I think that there are different kinds of shadow people, and there are haunting figures, but what fascinated me was the core shadow person experience, the nighttime visitor. And my current working hypothesis on them is, the latest twist in my research, and I've collected hundreds of cases, is that they are some sort of monitoring entity. They are not human. They take human form. They shapeshift into human forms. They may be connected with the ET monitoring because people, not everybody, but a fairly substantial proportion of shadow people experiencers are ET experiencers as well. They do not take us anywhere. They do not communicate with us, but I believe that they are monitoring us by tuning into our consciousness during sleep and dreams. So they're reading something of our thoughts, maybe the way we process emotions. We might even be getting some programming from them.
When you say programming, you mean they're embedding memories or actions or functions that we do every day, or what?
They might be embedding memories. They might be influencing the way we think about things, the mechanisms by which we think about things, or how we think about things, or even what we think about. Some people propose that shadow people might be part of a government monitoring, like mind control thing. I'm more inclined to think that they're associated with ETs because the abducting ETs monitor us physically. They come and they want to look at our physical data, our genetic material. I think that there's a good case that can be made for shadow people as not sentient beings, but some sort of programmed artificial intelligence or drone that is able to slip into our dimension while we're sleeping to gather data from our sleeping consciousness. When we notice them, when we wake up and notice them, they almost always disappear very quickly. They go through walls, they vanish. Even though they have mass and they can block light and objects, suddenly they have no mass at all. I think they are programmed to disappear when they are observed.
Are the shadow people dangerous or...
A lot of people think that shadow people are dangerous because the automatic gut reaction to them is one of great fear, terror, and panic. People say that they radiate this malevolence, this trickster, sinister energy. They think they're up to no good. But so far, no one has actually physically been harmed by shadow people. The question is, if they are programming us or extracting something from us, that may be where some sort of harm is being done.
They are specialized in intimidation, I guess.
It might be some benign intelligence gathering too, and it may be that it's their form and the energy field that they have when they manifest in our dimension that kind of triggers a fear reaction in us. But they may be just gathering data the way a researcher might gather data for a book. It's hard to say at this point. But there's definitely something going on with this phenomenon.
We're going to talk a little bit about Roswell here in a minute with Rosemary Ellen Guiley. But before we do that, I want to get back to you going to these places and where places are haunted. Have you ever had a terrifying experience, something where you really thought you were in danger?
I've certainly had scary experiences.
I mean, you're a nice-looking lady, and you look like the least likely suspect to be hanging around a haunted place.
Well, I've spent so many years doing this full-time that you can't help but have a lot of experiences. And they've run the gamut from really wonderful mystical experiences to downright terrifying, creepy experiences with entities I'd never like to see again.
Well, okay, the mystical experiences, what are you talking about?
Well, because I cover the gamut, I talk about angels and our spiritual
path. So you
feel
you've had encounters with angels?
I have had encounters with angels, many with elementals and fairy beings. I've had E.T. encounters, bedroom visits from ETs. I've had bedroom visits from negative entities. I've seen shadow people. I've experienced a wide range of ghost phenomena. And every now and then there's just a very you run into unpleasant presences that are very threatening. And yes, there are places that I have not wanted to spend much time in because I felt that the presence there was so sinister that I didn't
want
contact.
Do you feel you're psychic yourself?
That's how I got into all this, Jerry.
Okay.
psychic experiences when I was a kid and a lot of precognitive dreaming in my family that fascinated me about the unknown. I think everybody is psychic to some degree, and you can't investigate the paranormal without building that up in yourself. But I do use psychic sensitivities when I go out and investigate. I don't call myself a psychic. I don't go out as a psychic. Mm-hmm. But I think any investigator develops that sixth sense, whether they realize it or not.
Okay, the next time I'm around you, I'll remember that and what I'm thinking.
That's right. Everybody automatically thinks you know what they're thinking. But you're automatically tuning into their aura.
What's happening with you here in Roswell?
I came to Roswell because I'm part of the Fate Party. I'm a consulting editor for Fate, and I cover a lot of ufology topics for Fate.
Yes, you do. I've run across you at several UFO
conferences.
UFOs
have been a big area of interest of mine since childhood. So, and I'm always collecting information for articles and for books. So I'm interviewing people here for our Fate coverage of this event.
Well, you had a very interesting fellow out there a while ago. He was around Jesse Marcel's house, huh?
He was, yes. He was in the Air Force, Jack Trowbridge, and was playing, he's sitting right here in front of us today, and I think you should definitely get him on the air, Jerry.
We're going to have Jack here in just a second, but I just wanted to mention that you'd already talked to him,
yes.
And you're going to write an article about it?
We met yesterday, yes. We met yesterday out at the Hubcorn crash site field, and it was quite a fortuitous meeting. I enjoyed hearing very much Jack's description of that famous night at the Marcel House, all playing bridge, and here he comes home with a truckload of debris, and I'll let him pick up the rest of the story.
Oh, yeah, we'll talk to him about it here in a moment. But Fate Magazine, you're right on top of a lot of things here, and they...
Fate's
if they're around
edge.
Here tomorrow, mm-hmm. Fate still has their booth here on Sunday. So,
yes, my interview with Jack will appear in Fate Magazine and some other interviews that also interviewed Hubcorn yesterday out at.
And now he's the rancher himself, but he's a fairly young guy. He wasn't
yes.
around here. Anymore.
No. In fact, his family just bought that land in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. Hold on, Jane. I'm talking to our editor right now. Anybody have a question for Rosemary before I let her go?
Why did
Hold on a minute. I'll get you on the air.
I'm coming there.
Okay, we're rolling again. Jane, pick back up. Talking to my editor. Hi, what's your name?
Hi, I'm John Trowbridge. I'm the son of Jack Trowbridge.
Okay.
And my question is, with all this information that's coming out that pretty clearly shows all these things have happened, why is the government still so secretive, so suppressive?
I think the old habits are hard to break. What do you think, Rosemary?
I've tended to believe that there's a fear of social chaos or some sort of breakdown of order if people knew too much about alien civilizations. It's a fairly logical explanation. It does puzzle me how, if they are keeping a lid on secrets, how it's been kept so thoroughly for so many years. However, we do have other governments around the world making more disclosures now about what they've got in their files. And ultimately, I think it's all going to come out. And I think that there will be a certain amount of social disorder. You can imagine how certain religious beliefs would be upset with things that we might discover about aliens. and how we came to be on this planet, what their intentions are toward us. Naturally, superior cultures, when they meet inferior cultures, often overtake. And so if a superior culture is coming and having open contact with us, we could stand to be big losers in that.
You're listening to our show direct from Roswell. We're here at the Civic Center. They really had it went all out this time, didn't they, Rosemary?
This is great. This is the biggest I've seen yet, and I hope they keep it up because people are obviously interested in not only what happened here in Roswell, but the whole field of ufology and what's going on about what we know and what we don't know and what we should know.
We talked about Jack. He'll be up next. I'm Jerry Pippin and Rosemary Allen Guiley. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you.
Fate Magazine and now a TV star coming to a cable channel near you. Tales of the strange and the unknown. Every month in Fate Magazine. Fate Magazine has actually been published continuously since 1948. That makes it the longest-running publication of its kind. From psychics and spiritualists, archaeological hotspots and fringe science, to authoritative UFO and paranormal investigations, Fate articles are factual, informative, and entertaining. Subscribe to Fate Magazine today. Simply go to FateMag.com, FateMag.com, or check it out at your local newsstand. Fate Magazine is a favorite for people looking for answers and for people looking for entertainment.
Fate.
Tales of the strange and the unknown. We have a very interesting person here in Roswell with us. In fact, we have quite a few, but this man I wanted to talk to for a long time. Hello, everybody. I'm Jerry Pippin, and we're back here at the Civic Center in Roswell, and the 60th anniversary is going on. Stephen L. Fawcett is with us, and Stephen is involved in a legal action here in a moment I'll get into. But first of all, Stephen, let's talk a little bit about your book there, and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Jerry. I appreciate the opportunity.
So tell me about the book, first of all.
Well, it is a book of fiction, but it is based on the Roswell incident. I wrote it about 5 years ago, and I am a writer by trade. I was a copywriter for an advertising agency in New York.
Ah, oh, good ad, man. We like to have a Madison Avenue guy here.
And I was also a proposal writer for a major defense contractor, so I worked with a lot of DOD personnel. And I had a top-secret clearance at that time.
Now, are we talking about the Archangels of Dreamland? Is it?
Well, I just wanted to let the audience know that my background is as a writer and not as a researcher of ufology.
Is that the name of the book?
Yes. The book is called The Archangels of Dreamland. And
it's available, and we have a link to it.
It's on Amazon.com. Sold in bookstores around the country.
Okay, the novel is built around the 1947 UFO incident here
yes.
in Roswell.
And basically a very action-adventure-oriented book. It's about to be made into a major motion picture. And we've had great reviews on it.
In fact, you and I have talked before, at least by email, and I did look at one of those reviews. It was very good.
Yeah, and what's happened recently, I decided to come here to Roswell to give the individuals here a chance to read the book and to interview me. And what happened was that I had written the book very soon after the 9/11 incident. And my agent in New York had taken it around to several of the top publishers in New York, and they told me it's a very anti-government themed book, and they told me that they would not be able to publish this book in the political environment that we were in right after 9/11, So I had a multimillionaire entrepreneur friend of mine read it, and he said, I'd like to publish it. And I said, fine, that's great. And so he went ahead, published it. It came out very well. It's a nice production publication.
Yeah, looks good. It's a good read. It's packaged well, and
right.
As well as the guys do in New York. So.
And lately, something very disturbing occurred. He was listed in a complaint by the Securities and Exchange Commission for unauthorized selling of securities online. And the individual that had accused him of this is remaining anonymous. Nobody seems to know who's behind it or why he was listed in this complaint by the SEC. But the effect of the action by the SEC was that his businesses were shut down, and including over 5,000 copies of the Archangels of Dreamland
in his facility. They seized it, in other words.
The government has seized the books.
What did they do, just show up with...
They showed up. Marshals showed up at his offices in Florida, and they padlocked the doors, and he was out. And I'm just concerned about this. I'm concerned that this is a coincidence, or is this deliberate intent? And I believe that that it's a deliberate action, punitive action by the government, because he went ahead and published my book.
So, in other words, you got a reaction from well-known publishers saying, "We like the idea, mm-hmm. but we're afraid to do it at this point because of the climate." I've had that a lot of things like it happened to me broadcast-wise. Well, advertisers not going to buy this advertising if you talk about this, mm-hmm. and on and on and on. Mm-hmm. A lot of I'm not sure whether it's official or just everybody's feeding on each other.
Right.
But you're pretty convinced there's a conspiracy here to shut you out.
I have no doubt of it. I think that what's occurred here is in the first two chapters of the book, I lay out the theme of the book, and I must have stumbled onto something that the government really didn't want released.
What do you think that is?
I really don't know, but I do, and I was here listening to your former guest, one of the things that I think that the government is afraid of talking about Roswell and talking about why the UFO crashed out here is because of the technology. I believe, and this is what the book, my book, involves, is the appropriation of the technology that they found within the craft itself, I believe, changed the course of history. For the past 60 years, every major technological advancement in this world, and I'm talking about the computer, cell phones, emails, everything that we take for granted today, has its genesis in Roswell.
When you know you're not the first ones come up with this theory, and that is in your book in the first two chapters, you think?
Yes, yes.
And basically, I think you're right. And that may be one of the problems with disclosure down the line, is these people actually have taken this technology and they don't want to have to tell where they got it because it might be public domain instead of belonging to a corporation.
I just recently wrote the sequel to this book, and I did a lot of research, and I found that the one very interesting thing was that Bell Labs patented the semiconductor in December of 1947. And Bell Labs at the time was a government contractor. They were working hand in glove with the Department of Defense. And I find it interesting that that's a very coincidental date, just 5 months after the Roswell crash, that the semiconductor was patented.
Oh, there's lots of strange coincidences. You're absolutely right with it, and we've explored those on shows before. How about the movie deal? You're working on the movie people. They don't seem to be afraid of the book.
No. And I did write the screenplay, and it's being done by Valcom Studios and one of the individuals that's involved in it is Stan Lee, who's the creator of Spider-Man.
Yeah, quite well known.
And we're moving forward on that, and since I have the second book written now, it's a planned series of seven books, and and this second book directly dovetails with the first one, so it's a seamless continuation of the story.
Now, when we we talk about this from a writer's standpoint. Had you been to Roswell before you wrote this book?
You know, I've never been to Roswell. This is the first time I've been here.
You
it's great.
You sat down to use your own imagination to
create
this.
Yeah, I did, and I will tell you very quickly how the idea came to me. It was back in 1998, and I had a dream. And one of the major set pieces of the book is the complete destruction of Las Vegas by a massive earthquake. And I had this dream, and there was something with me there in the dream, and I saw all this carnage going on, and I looked over at that something, and I asked, "What day is this?" And this entity said, May 6, 2011. And I was so scared of this that when I woke up, I said, "Well, I'm not going to be anywhere near Las Vegas on May 6th, 2011.
Yeah, write that down. we have sponsors from Las Vegas. I don't know how good this is going to go over.
Well, I love Las Vegas. Yeah. you might want to think about May 6th.
I have to say, now, fellas, you know, that's a long ways away. Don't worry about it.
The next night I had a dream about Roswell, and I had never really thought about Roswell before, but I had this dream, and I woke up, and I'm not a crazy person, but I heard a voice, and it was clear as bell, and it said, "Don't let them get away with it." And I just, you know, I froze, and I didn't know what to do, and I was in a stage of my life where I really didn't want to write anymore. I had kind of written everything I wanted to write, and I really didn't want to do this. And I almost felt compelled spiritually to be able to move forward and write this book.
What was this voice inside your head, or could you hear it?
No, I heard it. I mean, it was like somebody in the room.
Man's voice, woman's voice?
It was a man's voice.
And so it wasn't a metallic voice or anything? It was just a regular voice.
Yes.
Out of the blue.
Yeah, I looked around the room to see
or
if there was anyone there. And so I got up and I started making notes. And the next day I saw the entire story play like I was sitting in a movie theater watching this entire thing. And it was like I was laying back with a bucket of popcorn and saying, "This is like the greatest story I've ever seen."
Well, it'll be interesting to compare that vision or whatever you want to call it with the final product that Stan Lee comes up with.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I just...
it might be identical.
It might be. I don't know. But they're not afraid of the government on this. At least I don't think so. But the situation with my publisher is very, very disturbing. And yes, it may be coincidence, but I happen to know the government from my military experience.
So the government's attitude is what? We're not ever going to release this book. This is an asset we seize because of other...
And completely unfounded. There's no criminal action. There's no anything other than some anonymous person called up and said he tried to sell me some stock or securities in something online, and they came in and shut the whole thing down and seized over 5,000 copies of the book.
Is your publisher going to get his day in court?
Oh, yeah. It'll occur, but, you know, I mean, the effect of this is
basically
that
they'll probably drop the case the day before. They've already made the damage. They've done the damage to you.
Oh, yeah. And you know, I've been receiving calls from Baker & Taylor, which is a book distributor, major book distributor, and Ingram, which is another company.
Sure.
And they're wanting to know how to fill orders, back orders from, you know, I don't know really exactly what to do about that right now.
Well, we're promoting the book, but you think Amazon still has some copies?
Oh, Amazon still has some copies. You can get it on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. And I think there are some other eBay is selling, you know,
okay,
copies.
This first time in Roswell, have you been here meeting people, talking to people? We're almost out of time.
Okay.
What's your impression? You found another story or evidence to back up your piece of fiction that sounds real?
Oh, yeah. And you know, I like to think that you can tell the truth through fiction. Just as easily as you can tell it through, you know, a nonfiction piece. So, you know, I'm very excited about the opportunity to be here and meet with everyone. I mean, it's a wonderful gathering, and I just wanted to be a part of it.
Okay, thank you very much, Stephen L. Fawcett. And we'll keep our eyes and we'll stay in touch. We've got to find out what happens with this very interesting case.
Major sighting here
on the 13th of March. Weird happenings in the skies over Phoenix recently. And no one seems to be able to explain what it was.
And now,
suddenly six amber orbs in a row, totally equidistant from each other, massive span across, pop up.
People say they saw strange lights.
A series of strange bright lights seen over the skies of Arizona gets a lot of people wondering.
There are another 10,000 Arizonans who saw the same thing.
Eyewitnesses who saw it say it's like nothing they've ever seen before.
Last night, shortly after 8 p.m., hundreds, maybe thousands of Arizonans reported seeing a triangular-shaped object with three to
thousands of people saw more than stars in the night sky.
The mystery remains unsolved and controversial.
There was nothing there before.
The award-winning documentary by Dr. Lynn Kita, The Phoenix Lights, is now available from shopjerrypippin.com. Order now. Supplies limited. I'm Jerry Pippin. We are at the Civic Center in Roswell. And I tell you, the 60th anniversary, there's not many witnesses around, but we have one here, kind of. You were right there with Jesse Marcel. Were you his next-door neighbor, Jack?
Was I when?
His next-door neighbor?
No.
Okay.
No, well, I worked for Jesse in intelligence.
Okay. And so you were in the service, too?
Oh, yeah. I was first lieutenant.
Okay.
And
this is Jack Trowbridge, by the way.
Yeah.
And Jack has an incredible story. We're going to ask him to tell it. What happened? Tell me a little bit about you first and your relationship with Jesse.
Well, I was fairly new to the base. I had been assigned in China with General Marshall's peace team, flying with the 332nd troop carrier. When my son was born, my wife had a difficult delivery, and they put me on emergency leave from China back to the States. When I was back here in the States, I was a B-29 pilot, so the 509th grabbed me, and I did not return to China. So I was assigned then to Roswell, and further assigned to intelligence with Jesse Marcel and Major Smith and Major, I can't remember his name.
Now you were, by that time, you were a lieutenant. Were you a captain yet or a lieutenant at that
point? No, lieutenant.
And then Jesse Marcel was what, a lieutenant too?
No, he was major.
Okay, he was. That's what I'm trying to get at. He was the top guy.
Yes, he was.
In your area.
Yes, he was A2.
Okay.
That's intelligence.
Yeah, and so it was his office more or less here in Roswell that all of you guys were connected to.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Now, we had various jobs within intelligence. For instance, I was a historian for the 509th Bomb Wing, and my job was to produce a monthly history of the activities of the 509th. Well, that was an in-service publication, not for public distribution.
You know, this famous picture of everybody that they took, everybody serving there, you probably were involved in taking some of those type pictures of who was serving where at the time, the yearbooks and things like that.
Well, after the incident, I was moved from intelligence to be PIO, and they shipped Walter Hout, who was a PIO, out somewhere. They broke up the team that had first-hand knowledge of all these things.
Fairly quickly, if I remember correctly. Let's talk about your incident of seeing. You saw the material, right?
Oh, yes. Saw it. Got to handle it.
Tell us how that happened.
Well, as I say, I worked in intelligence, and we worked together and we played together. So we were over at Major Marcel's home that evening for bridge. And Jesse was not there. He was out the ranch gathering this debris. So eventually he got home at night, and we broke up the bridge game to go out there and take a look at this stuff that he'd gathered.
So did he come in excited, hey, look what I have, or what? It was kind of routine, huh?
Yeah. And
well, I think it was so routine you went back to playing bridge, didn't you?
That's right.
Tell us a little bit more about that. You went out and looked at it, what, in the trunk of his car? Where?
No, government pickup.
Okay.
And he had a pretty good load of junk in there. Some skin of the aircraft, which was aluminum in color with a very high mural-like finish. And, you know, it looked like a Hershey bar cover. And say you crush it, oh, you think it would take... They remain crushed.
It comes
when
right
you
back
let
out.
Go, bing, it spun right back to the original shape. I saw skin. I saw girders there that had...
These are the famous I-beams they're talking about.
Yeah, I-beam.
And you saw the writing on there.
Yeah, that was in purple.
Purple.
And the... figures looked like owl to me, but, you know.
So they were little, in other words, like Egyptian hieroglyphics, maybe.
Yeah, very similar.
Uh-huh. So how big were these things, these I-beams the writing was on?
Well, they broke off the original craft.
But I mean, the piece that you had there, was it 2 feet, 3 feet, 1 foot?
The pieces were about 3 feet long.
Okay.
And he had a number of those things.
So what did the major say he was showing you?
They had permission.
Did he think it was extraterrestrial at that point?
Oh, yes.
That's what I'm getting at. In other words, did he say, hey, I have some pieces of a flying saucer? Or did he say a UFO? Or
I don't really recall what he said.
Okay.
But it was unrestricted at the time, so we had access to touch it and to look at it. And after the bridge game broke up and everybody went home, Major Marcel transferred this stuff from the government pickup to his private automobile and 42 Buick or something like that. And he got young Jesse up out of bed, and they looked at the pieces that he found. Jesse saw more that he was able to describe than I saw.
Was it discussed when you went back to the office? Anybody ever talk about
this? Oh, yeah. Well, the next morning.
Yeah.
He brought pieces into the office, and we looked at them and handled them. At that time, there was no classification placed on it. Later, they clamped a top secret on it and said nobody knows anything.
Now, Walter Hout, in his affidavit that just came out,
well, he was PIO.
Yeah, but you took his job.
Yeah.
Because they moved him out. But in his affidavit, he says that the stuff that General Ramey showed in Fort Worth was not what he brought him. Did Jesse ever mention that to you?
No.
Okay.
But I saw pictures of what Jesse showed up there in Fort Worth offices. And that was a weather balloon.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Huh?
Sorry, no doubt about that. But I mean, it wasn't what Jesse had gathered.
But Major Marcel never came back to you personally and said, boy, they really make me look silly here or something like that. Was he upset?
No, he didn't complain about it.
Okay.
But I felt that he was treated unjustly.
You felt it reflected on him?
Yeah.
For sure. Now, the general evidently came down here to Roswell. Did you know that?
General Twining. He landed at White Sands.
Okay.
He didn't land in Roswell.
Okay, now what happened? A lot of the top brass, as they say, did they show up here? Or did it was pretty more routine after that?
It was clamped down. There was no conversation about it.
Nobody said
release,
anything.
No, nothing.
It didn't happen.
Yeah, that's right. It was a non-event.
Yeah, you guys must have been dreaming. Go back to that bridge game.
Yeah. Marijuana was pretty strong.
Yeah, right. And we didn't know Roswell was famous for that. But anything else occur over the years? Did anybody in the military ever question you later to make sure you wouldn't talk or something?
Well, after it became sort of public knowledge, yes, I was called by an interviewer, author of some book, and I understand I mentioned in that from talking to him. But if you ask people who were there and were told to be quiet about it, they'll say, well, nothing happened.
So I'm just trying to get why everyone in the military, they just were good soldiers, I guess, that didn't want to talk about it.
You got when you're told to shut up,
you shut up. Okay. Yeah. What do you make of it 60 years later?
Oh, I think that we have had regular terrestrial visits from people from outer space. I think we've probably had help with the pyramids, maybe from them, help with the temples in Central America, moving these tremendous blocks of stone and putting them in place. And then there's the great big monument, I guess you would call it, carved into the desert of a man with a space helmet. Where did those people get
the idea
that, yeah, hey, the space helmet? I've probably seen it.
You think more or less the visit to Roswell and the crash is nothing new. They've been coming for a long time.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think, it was accidental and unfortunate for them that they had the crash. But
anybody ever discuss a theory on why it crashed? I guess it was a tough...
Well, now, a couple of days before this, we had a tremendous electrical storm. Lightning, thunder, the worst I'd ever seen. Theory that the spaceship had been struck by lightning and disabled, either the craft disabled, or if they had a crew, the crew disabled, causing the crash.
They do have severe thunderstorms out here. I mean, on the 50th anniversary, they're in the hangar. I understand Dr. Lear was telling me there was a huge thunderstorm.
Ah.
And so it said they'd never seen anything like that. And so maybe people say, a thunderstorm. Well, they don't know how severe they get out here, right?
Well, that was a big thunderstorm.
Yeah, it was big.
The good possibility that the thing got hit by lightning.
You know, now that people are talking about maybe there was a shoot down, you don't think we could shoot it down, do you? You were a pilot. You were flying B-29s.
I don't think we've shot down anything like that.
Okay. Hold on just a second.
Sure.
Anybody have a question for Jack that you'd like to ask him a question? I think you pretty well covered it, Jack. Okay. Yeah. Anything else you'd like to say, Jack, before we close the show about this incident, something that you'd like to make public now?
Well, I think it was unfortunate that the decision was made to classify this thing top secret and not to release the details to the American people. The reason that I heard that it was classified was that they were afraid the American people would panic. I don't think so.
I don't think so either. But that is a reason, and there may have been somebody that was a power that be that really thought that. especially back in those times, is a far different era than now.
Oh, yeah. That was 1947. That's 60 years ago. Yeah.
So anyway, let's give Jack Trowbridge a big hand. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
You are a witness to Roswell for sure. I'm Jerry Pippin.
I want to take a moment to talk to you about astrology. We all enjoy reading astrology in the newspaper. Love, life in general. But I want to talk to you about C.C. Stevens. She's in Arizona, and she is really a top-notch astrologer. And she does something a little different, and I think you should know about it. She offers to her customers the Book of You for only $35. Literally, this is a book about you. I don't really have time in a radio commercial to go into all of the details of why you should consider ordering the Book of You. So I urge you to click on this banner that's on this page with the show and check it out. And you can order it for $35. Check, credit card, whatever. This is a great gift idea, too, so order now.
This is Jerry Pippin, and we are at the Civic Center in Roswell, New Mexico, the 60th anniversary. And a lady that we really think probably was one of our better shows is back with us again. And she probably doesn't like to think of her life as a show, but it was an incredible story, and we'll talk a little bit more to her about it, Gloria Ann Hawkler. And, of course, the book is Diary of an Alien Abductee, and the top part of course, before the subtitle, which I read you, is Morning Glory. And, Gloria, it's great to see you.
Thank you, Jerry, for having me back.
Well, we like to have interviews with you any time we want to. We have a little bit of a movie that you made at one time.
Yes.
Let's tell the new people in the audience, and by the way, you can enter Gloria's name in our search engine, and you'll find this show. It's still there. Or you can go over to our Experiencers Gallery and click on her picture. And listen to the show, so we'll hear more details there. But let's get into, for the audience that doesn't know about this, exactly what's happening.
I am an alien abductee. The audience, they're looking at a woman right now who was so very close-minded, didn't believe in any other beings living in this large universe of ours.
You had experiences for several years. Nothing's happening to you now, right?
Yes, but they do not let me have the memories at present. Since my husband passed away in 2005, yes, I will wake up in the mornings and I will have markings on my bodies to indicate yes that.
It's still happening.
Yes,
But you don't really remember what.
No, I don't have the memories.
Now you have some pretty vivid memories from the past, which.
Yes, I do.
Tell us a little bit about what they did to or normally when they picked you up. We went through the story earlier that you had seen the UFO outside your window of your house.
It was on Labor Day weekend. Had just gotten home with my two younger children, and I had sent them up to bed, and I had collected laundry, went upstairs, and where the armoire was located, next to an open window, open door, I saw this huge light out. And at that time, in Albuquerque, they're getting ready for the hot air balloon fiesta. And at that time, they would allow hot air balloons to cross over the Sandia Mountains. We did live right there at the Sandia Mountains, at the base of the Sandia Mountains at the time. Well, I went out to the porch thinking it was a hot air balloon. And we were used to having the hot air balloons land right on our street. And the kids would have such a joy in going outside and helping the balloonist pack up their balloons. Anyway, went out to the balcony and watching this, and I didn't ever hear the propane go on and off. I called the children and I said, there's a hot air balloon outside. Come on and look at it. Well, standing out there, to make the story short, after 3 hours, this light, large white light, was still located in the southeast corner of our home. But the funny thing about it, after getting binoculars out, we would look through the binoculars and this large white light would go out, and in a circular pattern, smaller lights would come on. It was like they were watching us. This continued on till past 3:30
in the morning.
In that time, another white light appeared coming towards the house. And around 12:30 that night, too, we had noticed about a half dozen circular, different colored lights, peach, greens, blues, yellows, above the crest of the Sandia, where there are large radio towers located. Well, this is the beginning of my story, because about 3 days later, I experienced a very severe accident on my way to work at University Hospital. Walking down two flights of stairs, I got down the first flight of stairs and the second flight. It seemed like as if someone pushed me very, very hard on my back, threw me. The witnesses say that I was flying, actually, down the stairs. I was severely injured.
So do you think somebody pushed you or you fell or was it an accident?
What we have surmised that it was, that it was planned by these entities for me to be injured, I guess, because a couple of days later, laying in bed at home, I was not allowed to get out of bed. Both legs were wrapped. Anyway, about 10:30, after family and friends had left, my wall, the north wall of my bedroom, began pulsating.
Wall itself?
Yes, pulsating with various different colors, the same colors of these other objects that we had seen up at the crest of the Sandia Mountains. And for a while, seeing the wall pulsate like this was very soothing. But then what came through the walls was very frightening. There was five of them. Had never seen anything like what I had seen this night.
Wow.
And they came towards the bed. They were small, kind of grayish, big heads, large black eyes. I have never seen anything ungodly creatures looking like this. And that was my very first experience. Two of them stayed at the end of the bed working on my legs. They unwrapped the wrappings from my legs. One came to my stomach area, started working there. One came up to my head.
Nothing was said. They were just going about their business.
Yes, but all the time here I'm thinking I am screaming and I'm trying to get away from them. And I thought I was hallucinating so badly. I didn't feel that they were so real until I felt their fingers on my skin, my body.
What was that touch like?
Cold.
And then it was clammy or just cold?
Just cold hands that I remember, because I was very... There's no words in the vocabulary to explain what I was going through that night, because I'm trying to get away. I couldn't understand why can't I move my body to get off the bed, to get away from these creatures. My head is going like 90 miles per hour.
Uh-huh.
You know, leave me alone,
leave me alone.
And that's when I actually felt that they are real, what came through the wall. And I was so frightened. And
so
then
the walls pulsated, and then they literally came through that wall.
Yes, yes.
It,
so
it,
unusual.
It was kind of like a Casper cartoon where you see part of it, then all of it. Was that the way it worked, or they just suddenly appeared?
They just suddenly came through the wall. They just walked in right through the wall.
Wow.
Through the pulsating wall of the different colors. It was like panels of different colors.
When did you understand that you had a hybrid child?
Hybrid child? Probably a couple of years later. I knew that to be pregnant, and how am I pregnant when my uterus, when I had a hysterectomy? How can I be pregnant? But yet you feel the movement. You feel pregnant. After 3 months, then you're no longer pregnant. The memory is that more than once it's happened to me. You wake up, and normally the grays are working on you. And it's almost like, you know, you're laying there with your legs spread apart, and they pull out this very, very small little baby. At the time that it happened, I didn't think it was a baby until they brought it to me. Can you imagine, Jerry, a baby about the size of your hand or a little bit longer than your hand? Well, anyway, they bring this little ungodly-looking little creature to you. And yet, this little baby looks like you, and it looks like them. And it has the large eyes. It'll have the white of the eyes, like me. One special child that I got very close to, Winshaw, very delicate, very beautiful little girl. Well, she's a young woman now. And
You write about her in the book, right?
Yes, I do. Yes, yeah. Yes. And
have you seen her recently?
No, I have not. No.
It's been
no.
a while. It's but been at a one while. At one time, you did see her.
Oh, every time, yes. Yeah. I got to know this child, this little hybrid child, and she's my daughter. And she's very intelligent. I had polio as a child, and she did assume the DNA, you know. She went through the polio disease as well. And the first night, why they came to me that first night is because they took DNA from my legs. They took blood and bone marrow and other qualities of my body to give to her and this other hybrid child that I had.
They can read about this in your book.
Yes.
We appreciate you coming by and talking
to
us.
Thank you. Yes.
We could spend an hour or two with you, but yes, we have a show that's moving on here,
yes,
and it's time for a commercial break. And
well,
we come
back. Well, I appreciate
back,
you asking me to stop by.
And we have Stanton Friedman next, and he's a busy man, and mm-hmm, he's really kind of responsible for this whole Roswell celebration going on in many ways, and he'll tell you a little bit about that. And we've had interviews about that in the past of Stanton, which are available as well on our website. Gloria Hawker, thank you very much. And let's tell the name of the book one more time.
Morning Glory, Diary of an Alien Abductee.
And she's going to leave a few copies of the book over here for us to sell for her. And we have enjoyed seeing you again, Gloria. Last time I saw you, you were not feeling as well, but you seem like you're in pretty good health now.
I am.
Oh, well, great. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I'm Jerry Pippin. We're from the Civic Center in Roswell, New Mexico, 60th anniversary. Stanton Friedman next. Don't go away.
Hello. This is Farah Yildizu. Maybe you have questions about love, your job, your health, money, and more. With my psychic gifts and my tarot readings, we can reveal the solutions to your deepest mysteries. Please visit me through Jerry Pippin Radio, and let's find the answers together.
Click on Farah's banner for the answers to the most personal question. Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin. We're at the Civic Center in Roswell, New Mexico. 60 years. It's 1947. Stanton Friedman is our guest. If anybody knows the date, maybe Stanton does. You know, it might have been July 3rd. Maybe it's July 4th. What is the straight scoop here?
I don't know either.
You don't know
it
either.
It had to be the 3rd or the 4th. We know that Mac Brazel, the rancher, went into the town of Corona on Sunday afternoon, on Saturday, the 5th, rather. He went in there and was curious about all this junk that was cluttering up his sheep ranch. I mean, his concern was very direct. The sheep wouldn't cross the debris field. They wouldn't go to water, and they better get to water or he's got a problem.
Going to lose them.
Also, sheep eat everything, And if they were going to eat any of this junk that was all over his place, he may lose a few sheep. And he was the manager of the ranch, and so he was concerned about that. And he wasn't thinking in terms of flying saucers. He didn't have a newspaper. He didn't have a radio. He didn't have electricity. He didn't have a telephone. But on Saturday the 5th, he went into the town of Corona, and that's where everybody else was talking about it. And he had brought along some of the wreckage he'd picked up. It was just oddball stuff. And they were the ones who told him that there was a reward being offered for parts of this, these flying saucers. $3,000. That was a lot of money back then. He didn't have two nickels to rub together, as somebody put it. He was managing the ranch. He didn't own the ranch.
Right, right. He was a working guy.
Yeah, and so they suggested that he go into the sheriff's office and see if he could collect that reward. So the next day, July 6th, he went in there, talks to the sheriff, and the sheriff talks to the base. Now, there was already an agreement between the sheriff's office and the base, and anything that might affect the Roswell Army Airfield, the 509th and stuff, they would contact the base. Could be a drunken airman. They wanted good relations with the town. And so calls the base, talks to Major Jesse Marcel, who's the base intelligence officer, who happened to be the duty officer that Sunday. He talks to his boss, Colonel Blanchard. Jesse Marcel goes and looks at some of this stuff. It's obviously strange, and the rancher says there's a whole lot of it back there. So Colonel Blanchard, the base commander, orders Jesse to take one of the counterintelligence corps guys and go find out what's given there. Now, that instruction, counterintelligence, the concern was who was spying on the base. This is the home of the only atomic bombing group in the entire world. There were nuclear weapons around here.
And the Cold War was going on.
The Cold War was on, and Colonel Blanchard was very much concerned about, and nobody was thinking of alien space invaders or anything like that. So naturally, they follow orders, and Jesse and Sheridan Cabot follow the rancher out. No way to tell anybody where it was. People think, well, you know, show them a map. It's not on a map. The crash site is, 10 miles from a road, for goodness sakes. So they follow the rancher out, spend overnight in their sleeping bags. The next day, they see this huge debris field, and Jesse is frankly puzzled. If it was an airplane that had crashed, there'd be a big crater because they make a mess when they come down. He figured it had to be an above-air explosion because of the extent of the debris field, like three-quarters of a mile long, a few hundred yards wide. But what really puzzled him was he'd been at airplane crashes before. There was nothing conventional. Where are the vacuum tubes? You know, where are the wires? Where are the little tags that said made in Oshkosh? I mean, the standard stuff that you see.
Right, right.
You know. So he and Cabot each pick up as much as they could fit in their vehicles. They head on back toward town. Jesse gets in late at night, shows his wife and son. The next morning they go to the base, and we have some new information about what might have happened then. But in any event, Jesse gets sent with wreckage to Fort Worth, Texas, the home of the 8th Air Force. The 509th was part of the 8th Air Force. Everything is chain of command here. You know,
yes.
Major Marcel reports to Colonel Blanchard, who reports to General Ramey. He's in Texas. While Jesse is flying his stuff in a B-29, he's not the pilot, but General Ramey's chief of staff, Thomas Jefferson Dubose, takes a call from New York, not from New York, Washington, from Ramey's boss, giving him three orders. And I got this directly from Dubose. This is not third-hand information.
Okay.
He was one of the few people who was still alive. Colonel Blanchard was dead. Ramey was dead. I couldn't talk to them. And Dubose told me that General McMullen, they knew each other, both West Pointers, crusty old guy, he said, gave him three orders. He said, I want you to get the press off our back. I don't care how you do it. I want you to send some of that wreckage up here today with one of your colonel couriers, and I don't want you ever to talk about it again, not even with your buddy Roger Ramey. That's an order. Do I need to put it in writing, Colonel? No, sir. When a two-star general tells a colonel what to do, he does it. I mean, there's no arguing about things. And so when Jesse comes in, General Ramey says, you don't say anything. I'll take care of it. They brought in some balloon wreckage, radar reflectors that any three-year-old could tear. And what was strange about the material, of course, is that no three-year-old could tear it. You could fold it and fold it and fold it and unfold on its own. And there were light pieces of stuff, the weight of balsa wood, but you couldn't break them, burn them, cut them. Everybody knew about balsa back then, and you could easily cut, burn, break balsa wood. Mm-hmm. Any four-year-old could do that. And Jesse gets sent back to Roswell. Meanwhile, the public information officer had put out the press release. The story went all over the country. Too late for the East Coast papers and too late for the rest of the country's morning papers, just in time for the evening papers from Chicago West. And I have headlines from all these papers. A lot of people would have you believe, especially the nasty, noisy negativists, that it was just in the Roswell paper, not a major newspaper. I've got headlines from the Chicago Daily News, from Los Angeles Herald Express, from the Sacramento Bee, from, you know, all Spokane Chronicle, whatever. And the story died a natural death. As a matter of fact, it's kind of funny because the Los Angeles paper had a big headline, Army Finds Flying Saucer. Front page, all across the front. Smaller print, just beneath it, General thinks it's radar weather gadget. The fix was already in the same day. It's the only paper I know, I haven't looked at the Hawaii papers, that has both the, we found a flying saucer and no, it's just a weather balloon story in it. All the papers the next day had Ramey empties Roswell saucer, and that was the end of it. Now, there's been so much garbage put out by the nasty, noisy negativists. They make it sound as if the story got a second life because Jesse came running to me. Well, that's nonsense.
No, we have an interview where you met him down at the television guy. He said, hey, there's a guy you need to meet down in Louisiana, right?
Yeah, it was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And it was only because a reporter was late and the station manager was embarrassed.
And we have a great story about that on our website. And you need to go there and read the whole thing about what Stanton says. So, in other words, that's the reason I think you're the father of this investigation.
Well, that's better than calling me the grandfather. And I'm going to be a great-grandfather before the end of the year, which makes me really feel
well,
old.
So am I. I mean, in September.
It's amazing. Yeah, me too in September. Yeah. Must have been something in the air.
Yeah, you never know. You talk about the – I want to get into this late information here in a moment. And you've been very busy with other things that we've got to bring out. But as long as we're talking about Roswell and we're in Roswell and it's a 60th anniversary, first of all, down at the UFO Museum, you've been very busy. You had a panel last night. Do you have something scheduled for Sunday?
Well, Sunday I have a lecture called – star travel, question mark, yes, exclamation point. And I will show pictures of nuclear rockets and nuclear airplane engine and review the whole question. One of my points will be, too many of the people that attack interstellar travel say, well, look how much energy it would take to get to the next galaxy. Well, I don't care about the next galaxy. It's 2 million light years away. I'm interested in the local neighborhood. And within our local neighborhood, within, say, 55 light years of here, there's over 1,000 stars. 5% of them are similar to the sun, might be expected to have planets and life. And I will draw my target for interstellar travel from the Betty and Barney Hill case, where there was a star map observed, and Marjorie Fish, a woman building 26 different three-dimensional models of our local galactic neighborhood, very painstaking work, was able to identify the stars that were in a pattern that Betty saw on board the saucer. And the results are quite remarkable because the base stars turn out to be the closest to each other pair of sun-like stars in our entire local neighborhood, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli. And I didn't name them. Nobody can blame me for that. They're only 39 light years away, 39 versus 2 million in the next galaxy.
Yes, right.
And secondly, it's quite amazing. Not only are they both sun-like, but they're only an eighth of a light year apart, which means that 35 times closer to each other than the sun is to the next star over. So we're out in the boondocks. I don't mean Roswell. I mean the whole solar system.
Well,
and
maybe
those guys
both
got next-door neighbors, you know, which is quite remarkable. And from a planet around one, looking over at the other, it's visible all day long, which would be quite remarkable. We can't see many stars besides the sun during the day. Now, here's the real kicker. Those two stars are a cool billion years older than the sun. So in my lecture on Sunday, I will focus on Friedman's law that technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. If somebody's got a little head start on us, they're going to know some things we don't know.
Oh, right.
And I got a shock. I was talking to a couple of college classes at the University of Detroit a couple of years ago, And I was going through how much things have changed the last 50 years. You know, we in our lifetimes have watched a lot of stuff change. I said, when I started work in industry, I was using a slide rule. And I looked around the class, and I got no reaction at all. Any of you know what a slide rule is? Nope. None of the students did. And that was less than 50 years earlier, you know. So in the new book, Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, I talk about the star map work, but I also refute the many charges that have been made against it by people who don't want it to be true, I guess. And... You know, about the book.
Let's talk about that book, because we have your assistant, your co-author, the lady. Tell me about this, how you got involved with this woman. Maybe I should rephrase that.
Yeah, please.
Yeah.
I've known Kathleen Marden for over a decade.
Okay.
She is Betty Hill's niece, and she's also been active in ufology for Mutual UFO Network. She was in charge of getting people to be investigators, giving them tests and checking their knowledge and so forth. And we were, I guess the real genesis of it came, we were both asked to be present for an English television company to be at the actual location where the event had taken place in Lincoln, New Hampshire. I'd never been there. I'd been in Betty's house. I met Betty and Barney. That's how old I am. Barney died in 69, you understand. Betty and I had done a number of programs since, and I was the first to publish about the star map and stuff. Anyway, we got together because of this English television company, and we talked about she was interested in doing a book, and I had a lot of suggestions to make. And because of the star map work, and you know, it gave us two different opinions. Her training is in sociology and education. I'm a nuclear physicist. And we hit it off well. And my agent, I think it only took 14 rejections before he found a publisher for a book. And they've come through very well. And Kathy did most of the work, let's face it. But it's an interesting blend of stuff that nobody knows about, because Kathy has Betty's files, the tapes that Dr. Simon made. She transcribed a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And what people may not know is that the original book, The Interrupted Journey by John Fuller, which was a bestseller all over the world back in 1966, there was too much material to put all in one book from all these hypnosis sessions. And so John would use one answer that Betty gave to Dr. Simon asking a question. He was a psychiatrist who induced really deep hypnosis so that they could relive the experience. Relive, not retell. That was the important point. And Dr. Simon's background was treating shell-shock war veterans. Today we'd say post-traumatic stress syndrome, I guess. That's a fancier term. But, you know, your buddy's head gets blown off next to you. Some people have trouble with that. And so you have them relive with all the emotional and under deep hypnosis, and you can get through it. So he didn't know about UFOs. He didn't care about UFOs. But here were a couple that had some missing time, and what went on? They remembered seeing the flying saucer, but they got home 2 hours later than they should have gotten home. Something's going on here, you know. So Kathleen has read all the correspondence, has transcribed all the tapes, and you get Dr. Simon asking the same question two or three times under certain slightly different twist kind of thing. Also, you know, the noisy negativists insist that, if hypnosis was used, what comes out is what the hypnotist wants the patient to say. He redirects their attention to reflect his views about things. They don't tell you that in Dr. Simon's case, for example, he was trying his darnedest to get them to say that it was, Betty had some dreams that she recorded around the same time that had some similar elements to what came out under hypnosis. So Simon constantly kept trying to make them believe that Betty had the dreams and Barney picked up on these, and what he was saying was just a reflection of those dreams. What Kathy does in the book is show very carefully and in detail that that was not true, that Simon's attempts to explain it away as something other than a UFO-related experience just don't work. So we've had a good response so far. The book just went out last week.
Yeah, and the name of the book again is?
Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience.
Now I know she's going to be up at MUFON in Denver.
Yeah, I will be there too. Right. She'll be talking about her paper You know, MUFON, you got to supply a paper, which appears in the proceedings of the conference. So her paper deals with the new information about the Betty and Barney Hill case. Mine is 60 years since Roswell, which I gave here to a limited version yesterday.
Now, speaking of giving lectures, this thing at the UFO Museum that we talked about it about 10 minutes ago, 7 minutes ago, that you're doing tomorrow on Sunday, July 8th, what time does that start?
It starts at 3 until 5.
And so people can show up down there, downtown.
Yeah, get tickets at the door. It's
right.
They're charging for some of the things down there for their building fund. They're going to build. Boy, do they need a new facility because there wasn't room enough yesterday.
Right, right. Aren't you on the board there?
Well, I'm sort of on a board of advisors, and we're starting a new research affiliation, kind of, seven of us to handle, you know, it is the International UFO Museum and Research Center, but it's been a little short on the research. So there are seven of us who have been very active researchers to try to look, maybe get some support from the museum and use them. And they're a nonprofit organization, so they can apply for grants and stuff and try to look at some of the larger scientific problems about UFO research. One thing I'd like to do, might as well give it a plug here, we always talk about racing the Undertaker, about Roswell. I mean, people are, almost all of them are dead, so you better get to them before they die. But I am sure that there are still a lot of people out there alive today who have either first or secondhand information about what happened at Roswell. A grandson, a grandchild, a spouse, whatever. But they don't know where to report it. They're afraid of repercussions if they do say the wrong thing in the wrong place at the wrong time. So one thing I'd like to do is do a mailing to all the major newspapers seeking reports, guaranteeing anonymity, giving them a toll-free number. You know, sort of America's most wanted UFO witnesses kind of thing.
That's a good idea.
One of the things we'd also like to do, and it takes a certain amount of work to handle all the calls you get and stuff, is I'm also working with a man named Frank Fascino on a new book that he'll have coming out called Shoot Them Down, the summer of 1952, the biggest time and busiest time in Project Blue Book history. Sightings over Washington, D.C., radar, and all that stuff.
You know, in one of our shows here in Roswell, we talked in great detail about how many fighter planes perhaps were shot down.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, we're not talking one or two incidents.
No, we're talking lots of them. And a general admitted that we scrambled jets hundreds of times to chase UFOs.
There's new information coming out. We're going to ask Stanton Friedman. He's been involved with the UFO Museum. He knew Walter Hout personally, and we'll find out a little bit about that when we come back. And I'm sure there are a few other subjects we want to discuss with Stanton as well. A man we admire, a man who has basically a legend and is well-deserved because, Stanton, the thing I like about you is you're very thorough. And you keep checking and keep checking and coming back. And that's what it takes, really.
Well, I believe in have facts in hand before putting mouth in gear. That's not a popular view, you know. Shoot first, ask questions later is the normal notion.
Great way to go to a commercial break. The facts are on the commercial, folks. We'll be right back. Oh. I'm Jerry Pippin. We're here at the Roswell 60th anniversary celebration. I would like to take this opportunity to talk to you about a vacation idea for this summer or really any time that is unique, different, and affordable. I'm talking about a tour of the Grand Canyon in a van with Marvelous Marv, the world-famous tour guide. Marvelous Marv has lived in the Grand Canyon area for well over two decades, and he will show you things that no other tour guide will, and all the while fill you in on the history and the mystery of the giant canyon itself. When you go on a tour with Marv, you get to see the best viewpoints and the best exhibits. He knows this canyon. He knows this area of Arizona. Now on this page, there's a banner you can click on, and it will take you to Marv's website, where you can get all the answers about Marv and his Grand Canyon tour. This is a vacation you will treasure forever. Check it out, won't you? Marvelous Marv's Grand Canyon Tours. This is Jerry Pippin, the UFO Files. We're broadcasting from Roswell's 60th anniversary. The Civic Center is where we are. The big celebration going on downtown, the UFO Museum. Stanton Friedman is our guest. He'll be at the UFO Museum tomorrow from 3 to 5 with an interesting lecture, which we talked about a little earlier. We're going to get to the new Roswell information in a little bit, but first of all, let's go to the audience. What's your name?
Dave.
And where are you from?
Denver.
Okay, do you have a question for Stan?
Yes, actually two. One, do you think the United States government is going to ever acknowledge UFOs? And if so, what do you think it might take to trigger that acknowledgement?
Well, I've been interested for 49 years in UFOs, and I've been lecturing for 40 years, and I'm still an optimist, obviously, a cockeyed optimist, somebody might say. I have no idea what the U.S. government's going to do, but I think the best hope for something useful happening, opening the door to the real world of ufology and what the government knows, is if a major media group would spend as much effort on blowing the lid off the cosmic Watergate as the Washington Post did on the political Watergate. The press has been negligent in its responsibility, but I'm very optimistic because this year something very unusual happened. On January 1st, the Chicago Tribune carried an article, front page, above the fold, about sightings at O'Hare Airport on November 7th. It included information obtained under Freedom of Information from the FAA, which at first said they knew nothing. The observers were United Airlines employees who wouldn't let their names be used. It was a good article. But what was remarkable is what happened in the aftermath. They got over 1 million hits on the Trib website for that article, more than any other article ever that they had published about anything. And it led the list for 4 days, which has never happened before. And the reporter, John Hilkovich, got calls from all over the world. Serious people wanted to interview him. And the Trib itself carried a little article a week or so later saying that they were blown over by all the interest from respectable people in this subject. Well, I believe as a result of the word getting out that everybody's interested in UFOs, and newspapers are desperate for circulation builders these days. They're in trouble. I think that accounted for the fact that there were at least three other stories this year that were much more widely distributed than one would have expected based on previous years. The French adding a bunch of stuff to their website, which broke down in 2 hours because it was overloaded, that story got coverage everywhere. Fife Symington, the former governor of Arizona, Jim Fox, who did the movie Out of the Blue, was talking to him, and Symington suddenly admitted that he had seen the Phoenix Lights. Not the flares, the huge triangular-shaped object that flew over Phoenix. And he had been a fighter pilot, as it happened, so his opinion was worth something. It was out of this world. It's interesting that he and I and James Fox and Jesse Marcel will be on the Larry King show on Friday the 13th of July.
And that's a good way to get the plug. I was going to help you work into that, but you didn't need any help, Stan. You know, that is good evidence, though. Larry King has done shows about UFOs, but I think they're doing more things. You were on the Today Show. When are they going to show that?
That'll be next week, too, Thursday or Friday.
And you had Beachloss with you, didn't you?
Beachloss did the interview, and it was a historical look at Roswell.
I'm talking about
right here.
Michael Beachloss, famous fellow, famous historian.
Yeah, does a good job. And there was the story of the sighting south of England at the Channel Islands. Remember the pilot who observed this mile-long thing and some of his passengers saw it? That had legs, got much more coverage than one might have expected. So, also the fact that the MOD in England was releasing more stuff on their website, and it turns out that the Ministry of Defense in England had more questions under Freedom of Information. That's new in England. That's a new thing, Freedom of Information over there. And they've had more questions about UFOs than any other subject. So, again, it's clear that responsible, respectable people, people like us, are interested in UFOs. And it's good to see the acknowledgement of that, because what I've found is, I know there's a lot of interest after 700 lectures, you know, in 50 states, 9 provinces, and 16 other countries. I know how much interest there is. But what I had found, at the end of my lectures, I always ask, how many people here believe they've seen what I would consider to be a flying saucer? And I'll make a crack about the CIA isn't here, it's okay to raise your hand kind of thing. And I'll point and count, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The hands, when I first start counting, go up very reluctantly. They know I'm not going to laugh, but they're not sure about the rest of the audience. You know, each one thinks he's the only one who's had a sighting.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I get to the other side of the room, the hands go up more firmly. Typically, it's 10% of the audience, which is one heck of a lot of people. 500 people, that's 50 sighters. But then I ask, how many of you reported what you saw? 90% of the hands go down.
Down, right.
People are fearful of reporting, the fear of ridicule. Incidentally, if there's still hands left, I'll ask, how many of you were in the military at the time? And if there's still some hands left, you want to tell us about it. And I get some great lines after that. One guy in front of 1,300 people said, I can't. They told me not to say anything. It was a wonderful line. And I get some great stories. And so what I'm getting at is when I was at a college campus, 100 students in the class, and I said, you know, I want to get your views about things, but I don't want them to be influenced by the student next to you. So I want you to vote with your eyes closed, and your instructor and I will count the votes. And to summarize what I did, it turned out that 80% of the students thought most people didn't think any UFOs were alien spacecraft. But 80% of that group did think some UFOs were alien spacecraft. But our actions, will we report a sighting, will we sponsor a PhD thesis, will we teach a class, those are dependent on our perception of how other people will respond. If you think most people don't believe in UFOs, you're not going to talk about it. So people are shocked when I tell them that in the course of more than 700 lectures, I've had all of 11 hecklers and two of them were drunk. And you get that many if you talk about sports, religion, politics. And I come on very strong. I'm not an apologist ufologist by any stretch of the imagination. So the new developments are moving us, I hope, toward the point where some media groups will say, hey, we know you can't trust the government. Let's dig into this. And just one example of that, that it's never had the coverage it deserves. General Carol Bolander, who had worked on the lunar excursion module before we landed on the moon in 1969, was asked to look at Project Blue Book. What should we do about it? After we landed on the moon, he had nothing to do with UFOs before that. And the University of Colorado study, the Condon Report, had recommended that we close Project Blue Book because it really wasn't doing anything useful. So Bolander looked into the matter, and he did recommend it be closed, and it was because of that. But in a memo that was obtained under Freedom of Information, he says, quote, reports of UFOs which could affect national security are made in accordance with Joint Army-Navy Air Force Publication 146 or Air Force Manual 55-11 and are not part of the Blue Book system. And he follows up that shocker two paragraphs later. He says, if we close Project Blue Book, the public won't have a place to report sightings. However, as previously noted, reports which could affect national security will continue to be handled using the regulations established for that purpose. Now, any newsman should look at that and say, hey, wait a minute, they're saying the best cases didn't go to Project Blue Book. I've had two reports, for example, of a saucer going down the runway at a SAC base where nuclear weapons were stored. That's a national security problem. That's not just a dumb old UFO sighting kind of thing. So if the press would start, and I should bring along, and I didn't, but hold them close to the microphone, all these whited-out National Security Agency documents. 160 pages of UFO material, you could read one line per page. All the rest is sources and methods, they claim, which makes no sense at all.
Right.
And I have the blacked-out CIA documents. You can read 8 words on a page. So anybody says there's no cover-up, well, except for that stuff they're not releasing, which is the whole point, of course. And just along those lines, the French material. Some of the newspapers said it was declassified. It wasn't declassified. It wasn't highly classified material at all. It was civilian stuff, basically. So when we hear about people putting stuff out, let's make clear. The Ministry of Defense in England has released a lot of information. It wasn't top secret information. The French people have released information. It wasn't top secret information. United States government has released information. It isn't the top secret stuff. So there's plenty of room for a good newsman to win a Pulitzer Prize. Let's get with it, guys.
Well, a little hint there from Stanton Friedman to my fellow brethren of the media. They needed to pick up the ball. They've never really carried it very well. But I do think ratings are showing, you know, everything is sacrificed by ratings and advertising interest. Advertisers probably reluctant to get into this issue until they see the ratings and they say, hey, wait a minute, we'll try that.
There's a lot of ads that
use alien
themes.
So you have a reason to be optimistic.
Yeah, I'm optimistic, and especially this year.
Yeah, and you mentioned the commercials. That's the first place.
Hey, that's what gets people's attention. So, you know, it wouldn't be that hard, and there's another part of this, too. In the hope that new witnesses will come forward and guys who know about their pilot friend being shot down by a UFO and stuff like that, the distrust of the government, and veterans in particular, many veterans are very upset at the poor treatment that veterans have gotten coming back from Iraq.
As well they should be.
Well, yeah. What I'm saying is, what I'm looking for, the last conversation I had with Thomas Jefferson Dubose, by this time a retired general, he said, look, Stan, I like what you're doing. If I remember anything more, I'll tell you. What can they do to me now? He was in his late 80s. So guys who are at that point in life may well decide. And I have a model for this. Remember the My Lai disaster?
Yes. Lieutenant Cowley.
Lieutenant Cowley and Captain Medina and so forth. Remember, we destroyed a Vietnamese village for their benefit, of course. And one guy...
To save it.
Yeah, to save it. One guy courageously wrote letters to his congressman and newspapers. It got nowhere. But then the New York Times, Seymour Hersh, picked up on it. The story went all over, and then there were a whole bunch of other guys who came forward. They didn't want to be the first one. But if enough guys come forward, it's pretty hard to put the lid on it. So maybe that'll happen with UFOs.
Okay, let's get to the new information here in Roswell with the affidavit. Have you had a chance to look at it yet?
Yes, I've read the book, Witness to Roswell, by Tom Carey and Don Schmidt.
Right.
And it's been out for, what, 3 weeks now?
Right,
like
and
that.
We had them on the air for an hour and a half.
And I read the book, and they've done a lot of research. They give me a nice acknowledgement at the front. They don't reference my book, Crash at Corona, at the back, and I told them I didn't like that.
Yeah.
But... the affidavit, now I was the first one to find Walter Hout, and it was strictly, well, I won't say by accident, but I had looked an editor and publisher when I first started Roswell research. I wonder if there's a newspaper in Roswell. I didn't know anything about Roswell. So here's a publication that lists all the newspapers. Yeah, the Roswell Daily Record. So I call. I'd like to talk to this is about 1978, mind you. I'd like to talk to the editor from 1947. Well, long gone, what can we do for you? Well, Bill Moore had sent me copies of the articles he'd found up at the University of Minnesota Library about had Jesse's picture and story, and the Roswell story in it. Had a lot of names that Jesse didn't recall. And so I said, well, I've got this article here by a guy named Walter Hout, Hout. They spell his name four different ways in these things. Before I could finish the sentence, she says, oh, his wife works here.
Wow.
What? A GI who was in Roswell in 47, I knew it was a small town, and he's still there. So I talked to the wife. She's deceased now, too. Pete, great gal. Talked to the husband, and Walter had a base yearbook, and he has been a tower of strength and being useful. He knew where people were. Mm-hmm. Very well-respected man in this town, and deservedly so. And so Walter had... always said that he put out the press release because the boss told him to do it. He and Colonel Blanchard were good friends. And that he had never seen anything. As a matter of fact, he even told a little story that he had asked Blanchard, shouldn't he see something? He said, you don't need to see it, just put out the press release. Well, okay. And then I heard stories a few years back that Walter had been interviewed, and Dennis Balthaser is here, and Wendy Connors, and he had interviewed Walter. And I heard that tape. I wasn't going to talk about it, you know, because they had asked me for to
sure.
keep it. Walter was still alive, and he didn't want it released until after his death and so forth. Now, when I heard that tape, and he says about seeing bodies and wreckage, I was a little dubious because it sounded like he was being prepped a little bit.
Yeah, well, Wendy did ask a couple of living questions. We brought that up with her, and we played the excerpt of that out of an interview before.
Oh, did you? Okay. And so I was a little dubious about that, only because I've met people whose memories are affected by telling the same story 500 times, and they get feedback, and then pretty soon you incorporate
the story changes.
Yeah.
And but they still think it's the truth because...
Yeah. Look, I had a call from somebody, a man who said he was 10 years old and 47, and he had just been allowed to read the newspapers at the local library, and he recalls seeing an article on the front page of the newspaper, gave him the name of the paper, and it had a picture of the crash saucer with bodies out in the desert. I said, gee, I don't think so. I've done a lot of library research on what happened at that time. And well, he was insistent. And so, okay, I got the name of the paper. I called the paper, and they were nice enough to look up the papers for the dates. And, yes, there was a picture about Roswell. It was one of the pictures taken in General Ramey's office. And there ain't no bodies, and it isn't out in the desert. Now, I don't think he was lying to me.
No, it's just that's...
Misremembered.
Right.
Confabulated? I don't know. Yeah. Use a fancy phrase. So what I'd really like, the part of the story, there are two things that are very important. One is that General Ramey and Colonel DuBose were here at the morning meeting on the 8th.
Yeah, which was pretty astounding. And you knew DuBose is still in contact.
Yeah.
What about that?
Well, it's conceivable because it doesn't take that long to fly from Fort Worth here. It's roughly an hour flight. So if they're at a 7:30 meeting, they could have left there, an hour time difference. It's conceivable. And they could have gone back. Because we know that they were in Fort Worth later in the day, because we have the pictures taken in Ramey's office. And we know that Jesse flew from here there. So you do ask the question, well, why didn't they send the material back with Ramey and DuBose? Generals had their own airplanes, and a lot of the World War II bombers were used as planes for generals. General Twining had one, and other people did. So that's one of the questions that I'm curious about, that Jesse had never talked about seeing bodies, and yet apparently he did. Now, that's conceivable. But it raises a question. I wish I could get a look, for example, and some of us are going to try to find General Ramey's flight log, Colonel DuBose's flight log. I have General Twining's flight log, which solidified some of the points from the MJ-12 documents. I like documentation.
Yeah.
And so... now it's time to document some of those things. And one thing I will make absolutely clear here, I would never, ever, under any circumstance, say that Walter Haut was lying in what he said, an intentional misrepresentation, in other words. I just don't believe it. The man was too much of a gentleman, honorable man, and so forth. That he would omit telling you something, that's another story. I worked under security. Sometimes you have to do that. And one can respect his willingness to do that. The kicker is, what it doesn't change is that there was a crash, and it was alien, and the characteristics were strange, and all the rest of that.
So you are cautiously, skeptically looking at this, or what?
Well, okay.
Because you knew Walter very well.
I was in his home.
Yeah.
A great deal of respect for the man. He was one of the founders of the museum, of course. And I'm on the pro side, but I haven't hit 99% yet, okay? I'll give it a A-minus.
What about all the different crash sites we keep hearing about?
Well, you know, that's the other thing there, was this crash 40 miles north. Mm-hmm. I'd like a little more detail on that. Because, you know, we're talking about old memories from lots of people, and the kids in the neighborhood and all that. There were some kids who were involved in that one. And I just don't know. I certainly am aware of the crash out in the plains of San Augustine, which some people don't like me to talk about, but I do anyway.
Yeah.
I've been out there and stuff.
So what do you make of that? It was the same time period.
Yeah, I think that it did happen, and that Barney Barnett's story is legitimate. I think that one of the things that Don and Tom talk about is bodies being found 2.5 miles away, or at least another part of the object. Mm-hmm. That's what it says in the MJ-12 documents.
And you broke that story, too.
Well, I'm convinced, in my book, Top Secret Magic, and I would hold it up, but I don't have it with me, so you can't see it through the microphone, that indeed the original MJ-12 documents, Eisenhower briefing document, Truman Forrestal memo, Cutler Twining memo, and probably SOM 101 are genuine. And in the new edition of Top Secret Magic, I note that a number of documents that have come forward, those through Tim Cooper, are almost certainly fraudulent. But I do the same kind of research to show that they're fraudulent as that the other ones are genuine. I go to archives. I dig out relevant documents. There are things you can do, serious research, unlike the nasty, noisy negativists, as I call them. You know, you're aware that Phil Klass, for example, challenged me on the typeface on one of the MJ-12 documents. Just a brief memo from Bobby Cutler, National Security Guy, to General Nathan Twining. And he says, look, that's the large pica type. Perhaps you didn't notice that. But the tradition at the White House at that time and the National Security Council, which is mentioned in the memo, was a small elite type. And I've got 9 samples to prove it. Of course, he's never been to the Eisenhower Library. He got them by mail. And he challenged me to find any other documents done in the same size and style type. And he was so confident that there weren't any that he offered me $100 each for every genuine such document. He had a bunch of criteria you'd have to meet.
Up to
a limit of 10, unfortunately. Or I'd have been a wealthy man. So when I went to the Eisenhower Library shortly after that, I dug out 14 done in the same size and style type, and that met all his criteria. I sent him copies and an invoice for $1,000, and he paid me.
He did pay you?
Oh, yeah, he paid me. He didn't tell anybody about paying me. He told everybody about challenging me, and he got very upset when I used a copy of his check in my final report on Operation Majestic 12 for the Fund for UFO Research, which had given me some money to help cover the cost of going to archives. And he sent me a very threatening letter. His father had been an attorney. He was going to sue me, and I couldn't print that. And I told him flat out that, look, you sent me a check. I Xeroxed it. I took it to the bank. The bank cashed it. I can do whatever I want with that Xerox copy. And then he shut up. But it's typical of the intellectual bankruptcy of the pseudoscience of anti-ufology. The Eisenhower Library alone had 250,000 pages of National Security Council material. To say that, well, I got 9, all the rest were done with the same typewriter, is ridiculous. I mean, if you have 99 out of 100, probably the 100th, if they were all done on one typewriter, probably the 100th one was too. But from 9 to 250,000, that's ridiculous. So the MJ-12 documents I consider the most important classified documents ever leaked to the American public. And there are phonies, but if you talk to guys in the intelligence field, putting out disinformation is standard practice.
Well, in the affidavit, Walter talks about the debris field and the general directing this people to go down there, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the way the government works, you know, misdirection.
People, young people don't realize during World War II, disinformation was extraordinarily important. A perfect example is we wanted to get Hitler to think that we were going to invade the continent near Calais, and under General Patton, a great general, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so they built phony buildings, and they even stuffed papers, which were sort of innocent, but into the jacket of an English officer who had died, put him in the water off Spain, and they knew the Germans would get access to the papers that he had. And they hinted at a landing near Calais. They didn't blatantly say so. Anyway, when we landed at Normandy, the generals told Hitler we need the reserve troops. They had been holding back a number of troops to wherever they would have to go. And Hitler said, no, this is not the real landing. It's going to come at Calais. And he held them back long enough so that we got a beachhead established, and that made a big difference in the war. So lying is standard practice. When the first atom bomb went off over here in New Mexico, over at White Sands Missile Range, it was seen from over 100 miles away. It was kind of a big bang. And sheriffs got calls from all over. And so the military issued a press release. I've got copies of the articles that were published, saying that an ammunition dump had blown up over near Alamogordo, and fortunately nobody was injured. That was a total lie. I don't blame them for doing it. I'm just saying
this is standard practice.
There's
evidence that it's standard operating procedure.
Yeah.
Okay, the new book about
Betty and Barney Hill.
It's called Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, by myself, Stanton Friedman, and Kathleen Martin, Betty's niece. You can go to my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, and you'll get a copy that's autographed by both of us.
Great. Two for one.
Pretty neat.
And we have a link to that from our website, so you can go right over to Stanton's and get the book, and you'll be up in Denver at the MUFON.
Yes, and we'll have a lot of books there. I've got some here down at the museum. I'm almost running out, but I've still got some probably until tomorrow.
And in addition to that, you're going to be on Larry King with quite a few people. Jesse Marcel Jr. will be there.
Yep.
That's next Friday night.
Friday the 13th. We hope that bad news comes from the debunker who's going to be on. You know, standard debunker practice.
They don't bother me
with the facts. My mind's made up.
Yeah, right. And these guys always book both sides of the story, supposedly.
Well, you know what's funny about that, Jerry? You've been in this business a long time. But they act as if the two sides are symmetric, equal value. Okay, you got the serious investigators like Tom and Don and myself and Kathleen and so forth. We spend loads of time, money, and effort to try to dig out the facts, traveling hither and yon, finding witnesses, all the rest of that. These other guys sit in their armchair, and they do their research by proclamation. Why should they be given equal time with the people who have spent all the effort? I mean, debunking is easy. Four basic rules. This doesn't matter what you want to debunk. The same rules apply. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. But the public doesn't know. I'm not going to tell them. If you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's a lot easier. And do your research by proclamation. And this is what they do.
But with all of that said, you're optimistic, and I am too.
Yes.
The press seems to, the media, let's say it that way, seems to have understood that UFO material gets great reaction, sells a lot of papers, and gets good ratings.
Yes.
And so as a result of that, the media bosses who could care less about whatever they're doing,
yeah, of course,
will say, my God, we've got evidence here. Research shows us, blah, blah, blah. I go through this all the time with people in that business. Research shows us this. Let's go do some more UFO things.
I'm told that they were running, the History Channel yesterday was running UFO documentaries all day long, one after the other. Somebody told them something, I guess. And it is interesting that on the Larry King show, there's only one serious debunker. And there are more of us good guys than bad guys.
So well,
maybe
it's a good break.
They're getting in the right direction.
They're beginning to slant it a little differently. That's good. That's good.
It's time we got our day in court.
And the Today show's coming up sometime this week.
Yeah.
And we're not
nice
sure.
Nice interview.
Right.
They said Thursday or Friday, and I don't guarantee anything.
Right. And there's always a chance that something will be bumped at the last minute when you start plugging these things.
I've had that happen.
Yeah, it's happened to all of us. And you expect to get a little better treatment than you did with the late Peter Jennings.
Yes, I certainly hope so. You know, one reason I expected better from him, we're both born on July 29th, amazingly. We're both dual citizens of the United States and Canada. I thought I'd get a fair shake. I forgot Benito Mussolini was also born on July 29th.
Well, Stanton Friedman, happy birthday. Everybody tell him happy birthday a little early.
Thank you.
It's this month. Thank you very much for being on. I'm Jerry Pippin. Our time is up here at the Civic Center in Roswell. And Roberta Scott was our on-location producer. Jane Swartley, our production editor. Until next time, cheers.
Thank you, everybody.